This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. If you've ever had your blood drawn, right, and who hasn't, your doctor might ask, would you like to have the sample tested for HIV? And if so, your doc might include a specific search for the virus in your blood sample. But virus hunters at Columbia University have developed a more expedient way to do that, sampling for thousands, even millions of viruses all at the same time from a single sample. Ed Young is here to give us the story. He's a science writer at The Atlantic. He joins us today from the BBC with his selected short subjects in science. Welcome, Ed.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Let's talk about this virus fishing in human blood.
Right. So if in the example you gave, if you already have a good idea about what virus you're looking for, it's reasonably easy to find. But if you have no idea, if you're just trying to do a broad search for whatever is in there, it's very difficult to do that. The techniques we have are either not sensitive enough or too time-consuming and expensive. But this new technique called VRCAPSEC, or virus capture sequence, is a way of quickly, efficiently, and sensitively looking for every known human virus in a sample at the same time.
Every known human virus at once from one blood sample.
Yeah, so the technique uses stretches of DNA that are a match for all of those different possible viruses, and it uses them as fishing hooks. So it kind of dunks them all into a sample at once, pulls them out, and if you look at whatever's snagged on there, you can sequence the genome of the viruses that were in that sample. And it gives you who's there and maybe what they're resistant to, their evolutionary history. It should really shake up the way viral diagnosis is done.
I'm sure someday and soon we'll have it all on a little computer chip that plugs into your iPhone to be able to do it.
Right, yeah, something very small.
Yeah. A few weeks ago, we talked about sequencing the DNA in ocean water to get an idea of what's living in the ocean, just like your blood. Mm-hmm. And you have a similar story about sequencing the blood in leeches. Tell us about that.
Right, yeah. So if you go into a jungle and you want to know who's there, like which mammals are living there, for example, you could walk around and have a look, but you'll probably not see anything because jungles are thick and impenetrable and animals are rare and elusive. But leeches are really good at finding animals to suck their blood. And when they suck their blood, they get DNA. So if you go into a jungle, leeches will find you. And if you pluck them off and sequence the DNA in their blood, you get actually a pretty good comprehensive look at the other animals that are in the jungle that those leeches fed on. And when scientists have done this, they've found really, really rare endangered species, species of rabbits and unusual deer that haven't been seen for decades, some that have never, ever been seen in the flesh. And yet you can find them by looking at leech DNA.
Wow. Did they actually send people in to get leech?
Yeah, you can pay like forest rangers to, you give them little pouches and you pay them to pluck leeches off themselves while they're doing their jobs, stick them in the pouches and send them off to you.
Yeah, it saves getting that second job in the afternoon. A few years ago, you wrote about a girl named Lily who suffered from a serious genetic disorder, and you have a follow-up on her story this week, right?
That's right. So Lily was 16 when I spoke to her, and since the age of 4, she'd been suffering from these mysterious muscular spasms that caused a lot of pain, confined her to a walker, and kept her from sleeping straight through the night. No one knew what was wrong with her, and her parents thought that maybe she didn't have long to live. And she got her genome sequenced, and they found a mutation in one specific gene called ADCY5 that seemed to explain all her symptoms. So that gave them an answer. It gave them assurance that she had a normal life expectancy so they could plan for the future. And it suggested a treatment which helped to control some of her symptoms and finally allowed her to sleep. So when I caught up with the family again, I wanted to know how she's doing, and it turns out she's doing very well. But more importantly, they found this whole community now of people with mutations in that same gene. People who heard about Lily's story and Googled that gene, found the piece that I'd written, and contacted the family. And now there's this group of people who are all supporting each other, and they're helping scientists to first name the disease that was completely unknown, and to decipher its symptoms so that they can then look for other cases of people with a similar mysterious undiagnosed condition who now can get some answers, hopefully.
Terrific story. You have a quirky story for us about the Muhammad Ali of the marine world.
Right, that's right. So the fastest punch in the animal kingdom belongs to not to Muhammad Ali or to any human boxer, but to a creature called the mantis shrimp, which is a relative of crabs and prawns. It's a marine animal that holds arms underneath its head, which it can unfurl at incredible speed, up to 50 miles per hour underwater, and it can shatter aquarium glass, seashells. It's like being hit by a rifle bullet, this thing. Now, animals that are usually that well armed go to lengths to not get into fights. So they signal and they posture to each other and they threaten, or they might wrestle or test each other's strength. But mantis shrimp just fight. They go at it. They punch each other in these really heavily armored tails. And that's how they test each other's strength. They check how well their opponents can take a hit and how many hits they can take. So other animals use signals to avoid fights. In mantis shrimps, the fights are the signals.
Wow. So is that like trying to find the alpha shrimp, or are they fighting out to see who has dominance, or...
They're fighting over territories usually. They live in these burrows and there aren't very, you know, they're a limited resource. The burrows are where they feed and they mate. So the mantis shrimps will go in, they'll clash in the burrows, it'll be dark inside. So not being able to see each other, they'll punch each other to work out who's the stronger one before things really get out of hand. So then, one of them will retreat.
Yeah, you know, doesn't only happen in the mantis shrimp world. Just fighting,
right, yeah. I think we all know a few mantis shrimp-like people, right?
Yeah, and actually we have a video up on our website at sciencefriday.com of mantis shrimp. We did a few years ago a video of how strong and how fast they actually box. Ed, thanks for that wrap-up. It was terrific. Have a good weekend. Ed Yang is a science writer at The Atlantic. Now it's time to play Good Thing, Bad Thing. Because every story has a flip side. And now that climate change has been around a while, we're beginning to see its effects on nature. The oceans are rising, the permafrost is melting, weathers are more extreme. Not the happiest turn of events. But how about this? Scientists reporting in Current Biology found that when they looked at bryozoans, those are the little filter-feeding creatures in the oceans. These guys helped suck up carbon and store it away. Yeah, like carbon sinks. Is there finally some global warming good news? Here to talk about the good and bad of the bountiful bryozoans is Doug Main. Douglas is a staff writer at Newsweek, and he joins me here in our studio. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thanks for having me.
The good news.
The good news here. Well, so sea ice off of Western Antarctica has declined in the last few decades, especially in a region called the Weddell Sea. It's a vast area about the size of India, and it lies over a continental shelf. So the water here is relatively shallow, and on the seafloor, there's an abundance of life, including the dominant organisms, the bryozoans, which you mentioned. They're also known affectionately as moss animals. They look somewhat like coral to an untrained eye. They grow about 8 to 10 inches at most. And a study found that since the 1980s, the amount of carbon that they are sequestering or holding on to has doubled. So that's a good thing, because this carbon would otherwise find its way back to the atmosphere where it acts to trap heat. Mm-hmm. It's also a good thing because it's a rare example of a carbon sink or store that is growing. Most carbon sinks are either staying the same or getting smaller. For example, the Amazon rainforest stores vast amounts of carbon in the trees and vegetation, but it is shrinking due to logging.
So these are actually flourishing.
These are flourishing. Yes, they are.
And so what could be bad about that?
Well, the bad thing here is that as the ice melts, the surface of the ocean becomes less reflective, so more heat is absorbed. This is an example of something called a positive feedback. In other words, something caused by warming that's likely to make warming worse. It's also a bad thing. Sea ice loss in general is a bad thing because not in the Antarctic, but in the Arctic, it decreases habitat for various animals such as polar bears and seals. In the Antarctic, it also decreases, it affects the life cycle of krill and is probably involved in the decline of krill numbers.
Mm-hmm. Is the amount of flourishing of the bryozoans, are they growing fast enough to actually make any real impact on the amount of carbon?
Right. So
it's in the air.
Right. It is a significant, albeit small, effect. So the David Barnes, the researcher from British Antarctic Survey, who did this study, calculated that in West Antarctica, these bryozoans are sequestering about upward of 3 million metric tons of carbon dioxide per year. To put that in context, that's about the amount of carbon that is released by our nation's capital, the District of Columbia, every year. So that's while it is significant, it is relatively small. It's less than 0.01% of the carbon emitted by humans every year.
Mm-hmm. So what's the takeaway here? Is the positive feedback from climate change going to outpace the negative feedback?
Unfortunately not. But it is an interesting and significant effect. And it also might be having an effect in the Arctic. This study was just on the Antarctic, but there's reason to believe that the same thing is happening there. Bryozoans live there as well. They're distributed throughout the world's oceans.
Mm-hmm. So we'll just have to keep an eye on.
Keep an eye on it. Yes, I mean it's a small but interesting effect.
And we're seeing all kinds of effects that we never thought of. I mean, this was probably not anticipated years ago.
It wasn't. It came as a surprise to the researchers, but it actually is. They think the most significant negative feedback, in other words, thing limiting warming
balancing,
in the future.
Yeah.
Yes.
As a carbon sink.
Right.
And so when it dies, it takes the carbon with it to the ocean floor?
Right.
Is that
that's a good thing here is that when it dies, it basically just gets buried. And it is deep enough that it's unlikely to make it back to the atmosphere. There's, you know, very little bacterial degradation.
And it's more growing. So
right.
It's going to take it with it. Thank you, Doug. That was fascinating.
Thank you.
Doug Main, he's a staff writer at Newsweek in New York. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to look at sneaker science, running shoes, whatever you want to call them, the history of them. You know, it's kind of quite an interesting history where those first new type of sneakers came from. We'll talk about it. We'll talk about why sneaker technology is really at the cutting edge of all clothing technology. What's the best sneaker to have? And maybe you don't need sneakers. Maybe running barefoot might even be better. We're going to get into that also. So stay with us. We'll be right back. And you can also give us a call at 844-724-8255. We'll be right back after this break. This is Science Friday. I am Ira Flatow. Wherever you are right now, as long as you're not driving, stop what you're doing and look at people's feet. Yeah. I said, look at their feet. What are they wearing? My guess is that you're going to see a lot of sneakers. Maybe you'll catch pairs with iconic Nike swoosh or someone shuffling around in a classic pair of Vans skate shoes. Who knows? Sneakers are more than just a fashion staple, though. They are at the center of innovation, perhaps more so than any other kind of shoe. Technological advancement is woven into the fabric of your kicks. And joining me now to talk about the evolution of sneaker technology, Dwayne Edwards, founder of the Pensole Footwear Design Academy in Portland, Oregon. He joins us by phone from the Creative Conference today. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hey, how you doing? Thank you for having me.
And also Elizabeth Semmelhack. She's a senior curator at the Bodyshoe Museum in Toronto, Canada. Welcome to the program.
Hello.
Hey. Also, if you'd like to try your hand at footwear innovation, check out, we have an activity from SciFry Educate at sciencefriday.com/sneakerscience. And our number here, 844-724-8255 is our number. You can also tweet us at SciFry. Elizabeth, let's talk about how important rubber is to the invention of the sneaker. Where did the first sneakers come from?
Well, the history of the sneaker was something that I wanted to unravel when I started working on sneakers and sneaker culture. And so what I immediately realized was that sneakers, right from the beginning, were part of the technological revolution that was happening in the 19th century. They were absolutely one of the newest forms of footwear ever created. I mean, if you think about other things that we wear, boots and high heels, those go back centuries. So the sneaker was reliant on rubber. Rubber wasn't a new thing. Rubber is the sap of a tree. It's found in Brazil, parts of Central America. And certainly rubber and its elastic and waterproof qualities have been used by indigenous peoples to make even footwear since time immemorial. But the problem with rubber is that when it leaves those areas and would come to, say, Europe or America, it would melt in the heat of summer and it would freeze and crack in the cold of winter. And so rubber for a long time actually just stayed a curious product. That's why we actually use the word rubber. It was first used as an eraser to rub out marks. Mm-hmm. And so people didn't think it had much potential until the beginning of the 19th century, when a bunch of men began to do experiments trying to stabilize rubber. And so eventually the person that we're most, who we associate this with most, is Goodyear. And what he ended up doing was he boiled latex or liquid rubber and he added sulfur. And when the product cooled, all of a sudden he had stable rubber. Mm. And once that occurred, it was 1839, then the sneaker was then possible.
Hmm. Tell us how Nike co-founder Bill Bowerman invented using rubber, the Nike waffle trainer.
Well, I think there's actually some interesting synergism between Goodyear and Bill Bowerman with this sort of interest in rubber. One of the stories that sort of surrounds Goodyear is that when he was in debtor's prison, he began to use his wife's rolling pin and worked with coagulated rubber, trying to figure out new ways of using it. And Bill Bowerman in the 1970s was playing with liquid rubber and realized that his wife's waffle maker would allow him, if he poured rubber into it, would allow him to extrude a great deal of excess rubber and yet leave very, very high tread. And this was the inspiration for the waffle trainer, one of Nike's most iconic shoes that came out in 1974. And in addition, what Bill Bowerman did was he now had a very lightweight sole, but he coupled that with a nylon upper in bright, eye-catching colors. And so he was able to make not only an exceptionally lightweight running shoe, he also was able to make one that caught on in fashion as well.
Yeah, I remember when they first came out. Is there more experimentation in the realm of sneakers than in any other kind of footwear?
Yes, I think so. I mean, I think that given that sneakers are related to technological advances and have been since the first sneaker ever emerged, it is always a place that is seen as acceptable for the latest and greatest. I think mm-hmm. that one of the things that even pushes sneaker sales is having the latest technology in your sneakers. And we see also the first use of electronics happening at sneakers, and you have all different kinds of materials, not just rubber. You have synthetic rubbers, you have polyvinyl chloride that's being used, and all different kinds of chemical compounds. And part of that goal is to make sure that the sneakers that are being created are mm-hmm. the lightest weight possible.
Mm-hmm. Duane Edwards, you are one of only a handful of people to ever design an iconic Air Jordan shoe. How have the materials available to you as a shoe designer changed in the designing process? And where are we now?
Wow. A lot of like what Elizabeth said, I mean, the evolution of sneakers is probably the most advanced of almost any product next to probably a car, where we're taking things from vehicles, from spaceships, from other man-made materials, even 3D printed materials, to craft the next latest and greatest form of how can you make an athlete lighter? How can you make them stronger? How can you make them faster? To the point where what we're ultimately trying to do is make the shoe an extension of the human foot, to the point where it moves and functions at the same speed that all your foot naturally moves at the, you know, as you do different sports and activities. But it's come an extremely long way, especially, you know, as listen to Elizabeth talk about the rubber
right.
process. Now, you know, with 3D printing and other forms of combining rubber and TPUs and polyurethanes, even the evolution of rubber has gotten better, where it lasts longer. There's always a balance between if the rubber is too soft, it wears out quicker, but it allows you to stick on the ground a lot more firm compared to a rubber that lasts longer. It's harder. It's more slick. So mm-hmm. just even rubber itself has evolved mm-hmm. from the very first.
How did you decide to put titanium in the Air Jordan 22?
Yeah, you know, so I'll give you the real story is the Air Jordan 22. There was a rumor that the Air Jordan franchise was going to stop after number 23. And as I started the research of the Air Jordan 22, I Googled the number 22, and I discovered that the number 22 is the most irrelevant number in the numerical system. And so it's called, that's where the phrase catch-22 comes from. But along the way, when I started to dive deeper into number 22, I realized titanium, the atomic number for titanium was 22. So my goal was to make everything about this shoe twice as good as the previous version, which I also worked on. And along the way, I saw that the majority of the product up to that point were using carbon fiber shanks. Mm-hmm. And titanium is better than carbon fiber. So it justified me transitioning from carbon fiber to titanium, but it was also twice as much as expensive as well. But it ultimately became the best and the lightest support system we can actually create for a basketball product at that time.
We have a tweet from Berrigan who wonders, and being a tennis player, I've talked about this a lot, is there a difference between a sneaker and a tennis shoe? How, when you design it, what is the big difference?
Yeah, so sneaker is less of a category of product. So when you talk about sneaker or a tennis shoe, running shoe, basketball shoe, those are categories of product. If you go over in London, they're called trainers, even though here in the U.S., a trainer is a shoe that you wear at the gym for specific, you know, activities. So it becomes a slang a bit. It's less of a category. You know, now you can look at sneakers as maybe as considered a lifestyle product, something that's non-performance. But again, it's typically a kind of a slang for just saying shoes or athletic product here in the U.S. at least.
Mm-hmm. And certainly historically, tennis shoes have had wider soles.
So you can you can make twists and turns and things like that when you move instead of just running straight?
For lateral moves, yeah.
Yeah,
most definitely. I mean, the biggest difference between running product and basketball product is you're running linear. You're just running forward. And the shoes are specifically designed to make you tip forward to help propel that motion, make it even better. Also, runners are typically lighter than bigger guys. Like, say, you know, a basketball player who's anywhere from 6'6 to, you know, 7 feet tall, 250 to 300 pounds, they're not only running linear, but they're stopping at a dime and going the opposite direction, backwards or left and right. Therefore, the basketball product has to be built and designed a certain way to withstand all of that force that happens when you move left to right, especially the weight distribution that accommodates for that movement.
Mm-hmm. How lightweight can you make a sneaker? I mean, is that the goal? I remember back in the day when I knew people who were track stars. They had like kangaroo leather shoes. Remember those?
Right.
You're not old enough to remember that.
Definitely.
And they would use those because they were like wearing nothing. I mean,
kangaroo is the lightest leather. And, you know, whether they still use kangaroo mostly in soccer products, track shoes now are mostly made out of synthetics, which have the same durability and strength as the kangaroo, and they're actually even lighter because it's more of a man-made engineered fabric, where it's still a goal to have the latest, lightest product, especially in running, because that's the whole point of being as fast as possible. Their lightweight is also consideration for other sports and activities as well. It's just you have to balance how light you can make something, which is you're taking away, to make sure you don't sacrifice performance.
Let's go to the phones, because everybody has a pair of sneaks, as we used to call them. I had kids when I was a kid. Steve in South Bend, Indiana. Hi, Steve.
Hey, my question is, I understand the advances in the rubber and the soles are great. They seem to last a long time and everything, but the stitching that actually holds the soles to the uppers and the glues that hold the soles to the uppers, those don't seem to be getting any better, because I just bought a nice pair of $130 sneakers, and they're holding up great except for the stitching on the side where my foot bends. It's tearing apart.
There's advancements in constructions. So there's advancements of HF welding construction, where you can sonic weld two materials together where you no longer need stitching. So that's mostly done in things that are non-leather and or cotton-based because of the welding temperature needed to actually weld the two materials together. But you will see more product that does not use stitching, and its primary purpose is to create more of a durable product, in addition to making the product lighter and simpler to manufacture as well.
What is the expected lifetime of pair of sneakers? I mean, you're not going to design them to last forever because you want to sell sneakers.
Yeah.
It's actually interesting when you look at historic sneakers, because, you know, we have if you look at the 1917 Converse All-Star, it's totally fine. But sneakers from 1980 up do suffer quite a bit of degradation just from even sitting on the shelf. And so I think that it is a consideration of the lifespan of these new materials. They certainly don't seem to have the kind of duration or durability that a pair of canvas upper rubber soled sneakers has.
Dwayne, when you sit down, do you say we want a pair to last this many years or months or weeks or how does it go?
Yeah, no, not quite. But that is, you know, that's never a consideration from a designing point of view. The only time you worry about duration of life is if it's for specific activities like the Olympics. Since that is a two-week event, you want to actually make the product as light as possible and for that very specific moment in time. But for product that's commercial and it's sold mass market, you know, you're not building it to fall apart. But to Elizabeth's point, I mean, now, you know, there's different cements and glues and things mm-hmm. that are used that aren't quite the same because it's more some of the things that are used now are more environmentally friendly. Back then, they really didn't have a conversation about the environment and the effects of what's going to happen. Yeah. So those things are actually changing some of the cements and glues that are used today. But the advancement in how you make product has gotten better. Hmm. But the interesting thing, though, with when you look at it as sneakers, you know, people paying, you know, hundreds to 300 or even thousands of dollars, they're never wearing those products. Or if they're wearing them, they don't even flex their feet because they don't want to crease them. So there's this level of you buy them to look at them. There's a level of you buy them to sell them. There's a level of you buy them just to walk around and preserve them forever.
And to make other people jealous, you leave it out so people can see it. Let me remind everybody first that I'm Ira Flatow, and this is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. Talking with Elizabeth Semmel and Dwayne Edwards. I want to bring on someone new to talk about, you know, as you say, people are buying these for fashion or bragging rights or whatever. But what about running barefoot like some runners do, including elite athletes? You know, there was Abibi Bakila from Ethiopia who won the Olympic marathon in 1960. Japan's Shigeki Tanaka who won the Boston marathon in 51 while wearing minimalist canvas shoes. Roger Crum. Crum is a biochemist and associate professor of integrative physiology at University of Colorado in Boulder. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, Ira. Actually, I'm a biomechanist.
I'm sorry.
I got a C- in biochemistry.
Me too.
Well, I don't think I got to a C. Okay.
Well, let's talk about running barefoot. When it comes to running, you know, can these features enhance your performance rather than just running barefoot?
Yeah, I think that shoes can provide a lot of advantages. I mean, you guys have already talked about traction, and that's a big area. Especially, I'm an expert in running shoes, and spike shoes give you much better traction than running barefoot. But the other idea that I would throw out there is that whether you'd rather wear out your body or wear out something that you can buy and replace. So I'd rather buy something that I can replace rather than wearing out my knees, which are harder to replace.
I second that. Well, do you run differently? Does your foot hit the ground differently when you're running barefoot and when you have a sneaker on?
Yeah, that's a pretty dramatic difference. About 90% of people who run in shoes will land on their heel, and about 90% of people when they take their shoes off will run on the ball of their foot. And that's a pretty dramatic difference. If you think about, I'm also trained as a zoologist. If you think about it, your dog runs on his toes all the time, and maybe bears and raccoons are the only animals that really land on their heel. But humans can switch on a dime between running on the ball of your foot or running on the heel.
So when you're running barefoot, you have to do the work of the sneaker then in absorbing that shock.
Yeah, that's exactly right. A fellow named Ned Frederick, who started the Nike Research Lab, put out this idea many years ago, called it the cost of cushioning. So that he found that, well, he sort of stumbled into this idea. He was comparing the energy cost, the oxygen consumption rate when subjects ran with cushioned shoes versus barefoot, and he found that they were the same. And that didn't add up because he said, well, there's less mass on your foot when you're running barefoot, and that should reduce the energy cost. But he reasoned that there must be something that's in the shoe that's providing a cushioning that your muscles don't have to do when you wear a shoe that your muscles do have to do when you run barefoot. And just in the last 2 years or so, we finally
figured it out.
We sort of proved that there is a cost of cushioning, and we did that in a pretty novel way.
All right, you have to hold that thought because we have to take a break. give everybody something to come back and wait for. Right, we do have to take a break. We're talking about running shoes, sneakers, whatever you like to call them. Stay with us. We'll be right back with our guests to talk more about it after this break. This is Science Friday. I am Ira Flatow. If you're just joining us, welcome. And we're talking about sneakers, running shoes, the science behind the running and wearing and designing of them with Elizabeth Semelhack, Dwayne Edwards, Roger Crown. Roger, I was rudely interrupting you when we went to the break. You're trying to make a point. You want to repeat
sure.
that point?
Sure. Yeah, we were talking about the cost of cushioning, the idea that running shoes provide an energetic benefit. And one of my graduate students, Christopher Tung, had a clever idea, and we had people run without shoes, but on a special treadmill that he built that had foam, just like the foam that's in your running shoes, on the surface, so that it was like a belt of foam. And so people could run barefoot, but have the cushioning of a shoe. And what we found was that the energetic cost, the rate of oxygen consumption, was decreased by about almost 2% when people ran with on a certain thickness of foam. Hmm. And then we made it thicker, and some people used even less energy. Some people used about the same, and some people used even more. So it became sort of like a Goldilocks situation, where it seems like every individual has an amount of cushioning that's optimal for them. Some people, the 20 millimeters right. was too much, and for others it was just right.
Let's talk about the future of sneakers. Do you all think the sneakers of the future are going to be unrecognizable to us today?
I would say no. I mean, I think the human foot isn't going to change that much. And whatever the sneaker of the future is, it's going to have to fit on that foot. And so I think that there will be obviously humongous changes, but I think it will still be relatively shoe-shaped.
Well, I guess...
Yeah, I agree. I agree. I think it will be a shoe shape. I think, you know, depending on how far in the future out you want to go, I think, you know, utilizing 3D printing, I think it'll probably come in one color that changes according to what you want it to be. Mm-hmm. In addition to even the comments around the cushioning variations, I think that's what 3D printing can do for you. It could actually give you exactly what you need, whether it's cushioning or fit or even color and or materials.
Mm-hmm. Roger?
They're definitely going to be foot-shaped, that's for sure. But I think we might have trouble recognizing them. I do some research with a colleague, Alina Grabowski, on people who run with prosthetic legs who have had an amputation, and one of the big things there is to integrate the prosthesis into the bone, into the skeleton itself. And mm-hmm. I can imagine, at least, integrating a shoe into the foot more biologically. So we could cover it, we could attach, we could grow. You know, I listen to Science Friday too, Ira, and maybe we can grow shoes off of the bottom of our feet if we genetically modify them.
How's my museum going to collect those?
Well, it's interesting that you bring that up. Elizabeth, one of the reasons I asked that question is, how much does the present sneaker resemble that first rubbery thing they made all those years ago? Mm. It's not very close, is it?
Well, you know, I mean, it does have a flat sole. Oftentimes, you know, you can see the sidewall still remains quite visible, and they lace up. I mean, not all sneakers lace. We have Velcro and elastics. But from a basic architecture, I think there is a lot of similarity.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah. So what's the holy grail? What is the holy grail? What is the perfect sneaker? The perfect running shoe? What is it? Describe it for me. Anyone who'd like to try.
I think it's got to be very, activity specific. Mm-hmm. And so I think the ideal running shoe, as has already been suggested, is going to be quite different from the ideal basketball shoe. And then, of course, the sneaker that you see on the street that's just being worn as an item of fashion is yet a third thing.
Mm-hmm. And go ahead. I'm sorry. You wanted to jump in there?
Yeah. No, I would say for me, it's really waking up and deciding based off of your mood what you want and what you want it to do, and it does it for you. And you basically, instead of having, sorry, Elizabeth, but instead of having your closet full of shoes, you could actually then just go in and specifically print what you want and then keep it moving.
So you really think we can 3D print the whole shoe?
Oh, sure. You can now.
Oh,
it's
yeah,
just not quite functional
sure.
yet, but yes, it's definitely
Ira, you're
coming.
So 2009. Come on, get with it.
Yeah. Yeah, where you been?
Yeah, I'm sitting behind this desk too long.
I think the ultimate running shoe is going to have would be one that had zero mass. So we can't obviously can't get to zero, but we're down to close to 100 grams, which is about 3 ounces for a shoe that you can run a marathon in. So
well, I'm waiting for the aerogel shoe of the future. If that's zero math. It's great. I'm going to get at my 3D printer next day and go buy one soon. Thank you all for taking time to be with us today. Dwayne Edwards, founder of the Pensole Footwear Design Academy in Portland. Elizabeth Semmelhack is a senior curator at the Bata Shoe Museum in Toronto, Canada. Open it to everybody. Elizabeth, they come in.
Yes, we're open to the public.
And Roger Crown, he's a biomechanist and associate professor of integrative physiology at the University of Colorado in Boulder. Thank you all for taking time to be with us today.
Thanks, Ira. We've got to get you to Boulder.
And I just want to say that right now there's the Sneaker Culture Exhibition's at the Brooklyn Museum, so you can see the whole history of the sneaker. Ooh. Anyone can go there, too.
Yeah. I'm heading over.
Yep. Yeah. Yep.
Imagine you're at a dinner party on a grand English estate. An actor, a young ingenue, and a certain mustachioed detective are making small talk. As the cocktail tray goes around, the local vicar decides to take a nip.
I think I might have one too, if my wife permits. May I have my annual drink here?
This being an Agatha Christie novel, we all know what happens next.
Stephen, what is it?
It's all right, Tolly.
Talk to me. Stephen.
No, I'm sorry, he's not. He's dead.
What?
Oh, my God.
Oh, my goodness. He's dead. Could it be poison? Well, my next guest says, of course, Catherine Harkup is a chemist turned writer, and she says Agatha Christie had a special gift for the dark side of chemistry. Not only did the Queen of Crime use poisons to kill literally hundreds of her characters, but she had an unusual grasp on the science of poison. Catherine Harkup is the author of a new book called A is for Arsenic, The Poisons of Agatha Christie. She joins me now from Guildford, England. Welcome, Catherine.
Hello.
You're a chemist. How did you come to Christie's work?
Oh, I loved Christie when I was a teenager. I was reading her brilliant stories, very engaging, easy-to-read stories that have fantastic puzzles. As your introduction showed, you always have this cast of characters, fantastic clues, and you always think to yourself, I should be able to work this out. This is not beyond the wit of man. But, of course, I always get to the end of the novel, and I was never correct in guessing. I am absolutely flawed in my ability to guess who done it in an Agatha Christie, but I loved her story, so my Agatha Christie fandom stretches way back, and chemistry came in much later.
But you say that of all the ways that Christie's characters die, poison is right there on the top.
Absolutely. So Christie killed over 300 people, fictionally, obviously, and at least 100 of those were killed by poisons, but not just your imaginary, made-up, untraceable poisons. I think her toxic tally is over 30 different compounds, which is incredible, and they are all brilliantly integrated into the plot. So there's lots of chemistry and biological clues in there if you're looking for them.
How did you become so knowledgeable about all these poisons?
Well, she had a definite head start. So during World War I, she volunteered as a nurse in her local hospital, but it was suggested that she might want to work in the hospital dispensary. And this was a time, so, you know, 1914 to 1918, this is a time when all drugs, pills, tonics, creams, etc., they were made up by hand. So she had to do a lot of studying in chemistry, both theoretical and practical, to make sure that she got the right dose and she didn't mix the wrong drugs
right.
to hand out to people. It was also a time when lots of compounds that we would just cannot get hold of today were still being prescribed as medicines. It was a good time to be a poisoner. It was not such a good time to be on the receiving end of some of these drugs.
Well, now the poison that killed the poor vicar in our little audio clip that we played was nicotine. I don't think people recognize that nicotine could be a killer.
No, I mean, it's more familiar to us as the addictive quality of cigarettes and tobacco. But if you have too much of anything, it will kill you. And too much of nicotine is about a gram, possibly less, which is a very small amount.
Wow.
And it's mercifully for the vicar in your clip, it's a very fast acting poison. So though it was undoubtedly unpleasant for him, it was a short time that he had to suffer.
But wouldn't he have noticed a funny taste in his drink?
Undoubtedly. Nicotine is, if you're thinking of using it, you're going to have to disguise the flavor because it has a very strong taste of tobacco. But of course, he's English. He's a vicar. He can't possibly show his disgust or...
So British of him.
Absolutely.
Stiff upper lip.
Stiff upper lip, absolutely. From a poisoner's point of view, the British social crippling attitude of not making a fuss is an absolute boon because we will just swallow down anything just to not look embarrassed or show ourselves up. So he determinedly swallows down this drink, which he doesn't like, and it's the end of him.
It does. I mean, you write about Christie's first novel, The Mysterious Affair at Stiles. It's a great novel. Can you set up that mystery for us?
The first novel, it starts off, you've got this big country house, a very stereotypical setting for Christie. You have a wealthy older relative, you have a younger generation that are all short of cash, all desperate for their inheritance. And just to make sure that this older relative's time is limited, she's just married a much younger man and everyone's worried that their inheritance is going to go to the husband rather than to them. So there are many possible suspects in this particular setup. So it's very unsurprising when Mrs. Inglethorpe is found in the throes of horrific convulsions one morning.
In fact, fans of the Poirot TV series will recognize this voice that I'm going to play. It's Detective Hercule Poirot with his guess for where the poison came from.
The strychnine that poisoned Madame Inglethorpe was the same strychnine prescribed quite legitimately by Dr. Wilkins. The addition of bromide to a solution containing strychnine precipitates all the strychnine into colorless crystals which fall to the bottom of the mixture. It is likely that the last dose is fatal.
Oh, I wish we had that music here. walk us through this, Catherine. How did the poisoner do that?
Well, it's a setup of three drugs in combination. So Christie really went to town on her knowledge of drugs. So the strychnine, it would have been prescribed to little old ladies to perk up their nerves, and oh boy, will it perk up your nerves. So you would have about a lethal dose dissolved up in a bottle, but you would have about a spoonful a day, so you would never get a lethal dose. But the addition of bromide powders, which were prescribed as like sleeping powders or a sedative, if you combined the two, as Poirot points out, all of the drug sinks to the bottom of the bottle and you potentially get this lethal dose in the final spoonful. Mm-hmm. And this is absolutely accurate. There was a book that Christie very likely studied for her exams called The Art of Dispensing, and it describes this exact setup.
This is Ira Flato from Science Friday, PRI, Public Radio International. I'm sorry to interrupt there,
That's
Catherine.
That's okay.
And so it describes the exact setup, how to do this?
Well, as a warning to dispensers not to combine these two drugs.
It's a warning.
Because this happened in a real life case, and a lady died because she swallowed a lethal dose in her final spoonful of medicine. So it was there as still today, when you are prescribed drugs, you don't just pick and choose off a shelf. You are prescribed them so that you don't get the wrong combinations mm-hmm. that could interact with each other. So Christy had a ready-made plot from her research days when she was studying for her exams.
Now, I noticed your book. It's a great book, talking with Catherine Harkup, author of A is for Arsenic, The Poisons of Agatha Christie. You talk about some imitators who actually tried to use the kinds of poisons that she was using and getting away with murder, so to speak. But you also talk about some that may have saved lives. Christie's books may have also saved some lives.
Absolutely. Her descriptions of poisoning are so accurate that particularly the more unusual poisons, there was a case in South America and in the UK that people, because they'd been reading Agatha Christie's novel The Pale Horse, they recognized the symptoms of thallium poisoning and they were able to get doctors to intervene and administer antidotes and save these people's lives.
Wow, it's a great book, Catherine.
Thank you for
we geeks who love chemistry, and I also love mystery novels. You read what
83
Agatha Christie works. I'm working my way one at a time through it.
Oh, you make it sound like work.
It is. It's a lot of fun. Thank you, Catherine, for being a guest on Science Friday.
Thank you.
Catherine Harkup is a chemist turned writer. Her new book is A is for Arsenic: The Poisons of Agatha Christie. You can read an excerpt. Go to our website at sciencefriday.com/arsenic. One last thing before we go this weekend, take a minute or more to look up at the sky. Sunday night is the total lunar eclipse, and for about an hour, the moon is going to be completely in the Earth's shadow. But wait, there's more, because this eclipse will happen during a full moon, a so-called supermoon, when the moon is closest to the Earth, and it looks about 14% bigger. Peak eclipse time, 10:47, Sunday night Eastern time. Adjust your clock as desired. And if you miss this one, well, you're going to have to wait, because your next chance for an eclipse during supermoon won't come until 2033. Charles Berkowitz is our director. Our senior producer is Christopher Intagliata. Alexa Lim is our associate producer. Our site arts producer is Annie Minoff. Luke Raskin is our video producer. Our production assistant, Becky Fogel. Rich Kim, our technical director. Sarah Fishman is our engineer, spinning the dials here at the studios of our production partners, the City University of New York. And if you missed any part of the program, you want to read an excerpt from the book, this great book on Agatha Christie, go to our website at sciencefriday.com. We're also tweeting all week and discussions on our website. Go there and get on our mailing list, and you can find out in advance what's going on. And try to check out our Periscopes right before the show goes on, right at the hour, first hour. We do a Periscope right before we go on the air. Maybe you can come and watch it with us. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.